On this episode of the Radio Today programme, good news for Premier Christian Radio from Arqiva, and good news for you if you want to learn and develop radio skills at a very reasonable price, thanks to some new training courses from the Radio Independence Group. All that, plus Roy Martin and David Lloyd.
The Radio Today programme, with Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis. Welcome to the Social Studio.
Thank you for downloading this week's podcast from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Trevor Down. In a minute, we'll be finding out about a new initiative from the Radio Independence Group that's designed to share some good knowledge about skills and training. But first of all, I've come to a building just off Oxford Circus to meet the Director of Digital Radio for Arqiva, who is Paul Eaton. So hello, Paul, and welcome to the Radio Today programme.
Hello, and welcome to Arqiva Tower.
Is there anything that you at Arqiva don't own and do? You seem to be the sort of monopoly supplier of pretty much everything that we listen to on British radio. Is that fair?
I think that's probably fair. Apart from the radio stations themselves, you know, we're completely independent of any of our customers. We don't produce any radio programmes ourselves, but we are an infrastructure provider. And I mean, you'll probably know that the constituent parts of Arqiva were the BBC's transmission business and the IBA's transmission business going back many years. And we're just sort of the logical extension of that that was turned in the 80s and 90s into a commercial enterprise, looking at really long-term returns for our shareholders.
What's the rationale for being a monopoly? I mean, shouldn't you welcome competition? Big businesses usually say that, don't they? When new entrants arrive, they say, oh yes, we welcome this competition.
Yeah, we didn't set out to be a monopoly. I think it's fair to say that the reasons for merging together what was National Grid Wireless and the smaller Arqiva business in 2007 and 8 was not to, you know, create a monopoly. It was to create an organisation that was capable of delivering the television digital switchover. Prior to the acquisition, Arqiva had won the BBC's digital terrestrial television business, but it was proving very difficult to deliver that. And there was nothing in our strategy at the time that aimed at creating a monopoly specifically to address the commercial radio business at all.
Who keeps you on your toes then? You know, what stops you just being a Stalinist organisation that can do pretty well what you like?
Well, we signed some undertakings with the Competition Commission in 2008, which have been adhered to ever since. Now, that sets the way that we price our transmission. So in selected areas, such as network access and managed transmission services, we've got very tightly regulated policies on who we talk to, how we talk to them, segregations within the business, and the prices that we charge.
And is this Ofcom that sit on your shoulder?
Yeah, there's a transmission adjudicator who works as part of Ofcom who sits on our shoulder, and he's there for any of our customers to consult with, and he keeps us sort of fresh.
So you're not in charge of the content that's transmitted on your transmitters. Is it your decision, though, that some stations are on and some are off? I mean, there's been a lot of talk recently about Premier Christian Radio being, quote, kicked off. And you tend to get the blame for that. Is it your decision that that kind of thing happens?
For digital radio, Ofcom set up a system such that the under the Broadcasting Act, multiplex operators hold the licences for digital radio multiplexes, national and local. And we certainly hold a good number of those. We've got over 20 local licences plus the digital one national licence. We have an open policy on fair and effective competition, and we will respond to any inquiries from any credible content provider for capacity on any of those multiplexes. And many of them have capacity on them. And we brought on a lot of smaller operators, such as Angel Radio in Hampshire, Connect in Essex, and Heartsbeds and Bucks, and a whole load of others. So, you know, we've been very open. We don't have our own stations to compete with our customers, so we're really happy to have anybody on our multiplexes. But at the end of the day, somebody has to make a choice, and we do make a choice. But Ofcom have to approve any change to the multiplex.
And is that choice made on the basis of how much money somebody is going to pay you?
That is part of it. I mean, clearly, we're a business, as indeed are all of the multiplex operators, and indeed are all the radio stations. So, you know, we're looking to make a profit overall at the end of the day. So money does come into it. We would expect our customers to be able to pay their bills. So if they sign up to a contract, you know, we're not forcing their arm on any of these things. They sign up to a contract and we'd expect them to comply with that. You mentioned Premier Christian Radio. Premier's contract came to an end. We weren't kicking them off. We weren't evicting them. You know, weren't drowning them or whatever, all the other terms that I've heard used. But so we were in a position in December where, you know, it clearly wasn't the right thing to do to take them off air then. So we extended their contract until the end of March. We've had some very constructive conversations in the last few days with Peter Kerridge, and I'm really confident that we can get a deal together that will have them remaining on Digital One for the foreseeable future.
That's good, very good news. So if it's about money, Paul, potentially anybody who's got more money than a current operator can come to you at the end of their licence and say, I'll pay you a bit more than they do for their bit of bandwidth.
It's possible. I think the problems that we've had over the years since we acquired these licences has been actually the opposite one, that we've had difficulty sometimes finding enough capacity. When we took the licences from Global, when we acquired them from Global in 2009, Digital One had four services on it, and the local multiplexes just had Global services and the BBC services on it. So I think we've come a long way from there, but I think we're still far from a situation where the demand is exceeding the supply to a great degree. Digital One looks full, and it is pretty full. But there, you know, buried in there are, you know, a whole range of different agreements of different durations. So there's always opportunities for people to come along with good ideas to get onto digital radio. All the capacity is not tied up for the entire licence term.
And Paul, is there any limit to the amount of squeezing you can do? You know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about, you know, the Dash to Mono and how too many stations arguably are broadcasting without enough bandwidth, so they can't be stereo. I guess it might be argued that it's in your interest to squeeze as many stations on as you can and, as it were, bugger the quality.
Well, no, we're completely neutral to that, because if you imagine a situation where a particular unit of the multiplex capacity is sold at the same rate, it actually doesn't matter to us whether the stereo or mono service is on there. If it's purely a financial thing, there could just as easily be half as many stereo services as there are mono services currently. So we don't mind at all whether they're mono or stereo.
So do you sell it by the kilobit per second or whatever it is?
Well, we sell it by the capacity unit, and there's a slightly loose relationship between capacity units and kilobits per second, which is quite difficult to explain in the few minutes we've got. But basically, the multiplex has a certain number of capacity units, 864, and each of the radio stations uses an appropriate amount for the bit rate that they're using. So a normal mono service at 64 kilobits per second uses 48 of these capacity units. So you can probably squeeze about sort of 19 or 20 of them on, whereas stereo uses between 84 and 96 capacity units.
You're a listener. You must think, when you tune into your multiplex, you must think, it's a shame that all these stations are in mono, isn't it?
Well, do you know, I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask. I'm a little hard of hearing and I can't tell the difference. Seriously, I think it's a pity, and yet it's the way of generating as much choice as we can from the limited resource we've got. I mean, who knows, with the advent of the second national DAB multiplex, perhaps there'll be more of a shift towards stereo services, particularly on Digital One. And, you know, I think that would be welcomed by many people. But I think there are many people out there, and I would take, you know, the average listener as the example there, who generally can't tell the difference between a 64 kilobit per second mono service and a glorious stereo service such as Classic FM.
There'll be people listening to this howling at you, Paul, but let's leave that hanging. So you run D1. You're part of one of the bids for D2. Paul, haven't you already got enough?
I think you might argue that. I think The prospect of another multiplex being partially owned by Arqiva is actually quite a good one for the industry because, I mean, first of all, we were the only one of the bidders who advertised for content as part of the application process. We got over 30 credible expressions of interest from prospective service providers. And, you know, we haven't steered anybody in any particular direction. It's completely open to anyone. I think that's one of the good things of having independent operators looking after the DAB multiplexes. I think also you'll see from our application, and frankly from the application of Listen to Digital as well, that these networks are being aimed at a different prospective customer, a different radio station, that they're very much lower cost, whereas the Digital One network is designed to deliver FM equivalents as required, you know, as one of the switchover criteria. And as a consequence, Digital One is, or the prices for access for Digital One are more aligned to national radio stations who are simulcasting than it is to sort of smaller startup stations. So I think there's a place for both of them.
I haven't managed yet to persuade Babcock that they'd like to talk to me for this podcast. So I think I should just mention that when I ask you this question, which is, how difficult is it to roll out another digital channel, as it were, another series of multiplexes around the country? I'm not sure many people actually know what a multiplex is. I mean, is it a thing can I get it in my hand, or is it as big as a car, or does it need a big mast like a conventional transmitter? I mean, what does it look like?
The multiplex in its loosest term just refers to everything about that network, and the network, I guess, has four constituent parts. It has transmitters on hilltops. Our network, our proposed network for Sound Digital, is 45 transmitters, covering around 75% of the population.
And these are new transmitters you've got to put up, are they?
They're existing masts, and in many cases existing antennas, but new transmitters that need to be combined with the existing BBC and Digital One and local digital transmitters. So we're going to use existing transmitter sites. So, you know, it's going to hit as much population as it can for the number of transmitters. So we've got those new transmitters. We've got to get the multiplex out to those transmitters. So we have a distribution network, and we're proposing to use a dual satellite system, just like Digital One and BBC use. We then need the multiplexer, which would sit in a couple of different buildings for redundancy, and it's it's basically a powerful PC which brings together all of the radio services from the various operators who are going to be providing services to Sound Digital into one signal that can be broadcast all together.
So just to be clear about this, if your competitors win it, will they have to come to you and say, can we put one of our transmitters up on one of your masts?
Well, they've been quite coy about the information that they provided publicly about the network. So I can't be sure, but I suspect in some cases they'll be using Arqiva masts. And we talked earlier about the network access product that Arqiva has to provide from a regulatory point of view. And my colleagues in Arqiva, who I don't actually have any direct contact with, will have been talking to Listen to Digital with a view to providing access to those masts on the same terms that Sound Digital has access to those masts.
Okay, so in that sense, from a listener's point of view, forgetting the programming and the stations in each bid, technically, would you say they're pretty much the same?
Well, theirs is for 42 transmitters, ours is 45, and I think, you know, we've each calculated our population coverage. I think theirs is different to ours. We've validated ours against all of the data we've ever put together on the coverage of digital networks, and we're very confident of the numbers we've presented. Ofcom will independently assess that. I would expect our network to be marginally better with more transmitters than theirs, but I don't think there's much in it.
Well, if that doesn't persuade Babcock to take part in a future edition of this podcast, I don't know what will.
There you go.
So, how much have you been involved in the other parts of the bid, or is your job simply to say, yes, guys, we can make this happen technically?
No, Glyn Jones and I have been the ones within Arqiva who have been talking to the prospective third-party service providers. So we've had some really enjoyable conversations with over 30 prospective providers, and it's, you know, it's through those contacts that that we put together this lineup. And we've worked incredibly closely with guys at UTV. I should mention Jimmy Buckland and Piers Collins, and at Bauer, particularly Gray Allen. We've worked very closely with all of them in putting together the bid. So, you know, we had many a late night putting that application together.
We often talk about DAB on this podcast. We talked about it last week at the Drive to Digital conference, and there are people, obviously, particularly within DIUK, maybe within the motor industry, who simply want FM to be switched off, or that there is an announcement that it will be at some stage. Does Arqiva have a position on digital switchover?
We support digital switchover because it gives a firm focus on the future for the radio industry. We're no great supporters of dual transmission. It is wasteful in many ways, but it also gives Arqiva and our shareholders the uncertainty of not knowing where to spend our money, where to invest. We would have to spend just as much replacing our analog networks, if they're to be required for the future, as we would to build out the digital networks to FM equivalents. And in fact, if you look at the overall costs of transmission long term, you know, for UK PLC, if we switched off all of the analog networks and built out the digital networks to their equivalents, the overall transmission charges would be less than they are at the moment.
I've asked this question several times of various different people, and I know some of the listeners will find this a bit boring, but here it comes again. Why does DAB go off five times between my house and the railway station that I go to? And whose fault is it? I put it to you, Pauline, that it's your fault.
It probably is, Trevor. It probably is. I think there's a lot of work still to do to build out, particularly the local network, to in any way match the coverage that you currently get with FM. And there are areas like Cambridge where transmitters are quite sparsely populated. There's a lot more to do in those areas. And that's all part of the plan which has been put together by the industry and endorsed by DCMS and the Minister on a number of occasions to build out those networks. So we've got a plan now to build out and improve well over 200 local DAB transmitters that will give your coverage. No, it should get rid of those not spots for
jam you. Tomorrow.
Well, it's tomorrow, but you know, it's next 18 months, something like that. You know, that's a project that should be finished next summer, now that the approvals are all in place and the project has started.
Paul, thank you ever so much for talking to us today. I found that very interesting, and I'm not going to wish you good luck with your bid because that wouldn't be fair on your competitors, but it's very kind of you to have me here at Arqiva Towers. It is the Radio Today programme. Let's have some news now, shall we? Here's Roy.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Thank you, Trevor. The entries are open for this year's Arqiva Commercial Radio Awards. The closing date is the 20th of March if you're submitting an entry, and good luck. Zane Lowe is leaving BBC Radio 1 after 11 years to join Apple in America. Rumours say he's joining to help out with a new streaming music service rather than serving in the Genius Bar. And a number of community radio stations have been found in breach of their licence conditions, their key commitments this week, including Corby Radio and North Manchester FM. Find out more on these stories at radiotoday.co.uk. That's the latest. I'm Roy Martin.
Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis, offer you elegantly integrated products and intelligent one-stop shopping for all your studio needs. Discover a full range of innovative studio products. Play out by Wide Orbit, Music Master Scheduling, Stirlitz, Newsboss, Larvo, Telos, Axia, Omnia, Digigram and Commotion. Visit bionics.co.uk today.
The Radio Today programme brings me to some fascinating places, and now I've come to Whistledown Productions to meet David Press. David, is this where you do feedback?
It is. You're sitting in Roger Bolton's hot seat.
Fascinating. We're here to talk about Rig Train.
Can you all see the blood on the walls?
I can. Because you are such an illustrious documentary maker, I think it ill behooves me to ask the first question. So if you were producing this item about Rig's new training initiative, what should be the first question?
Well, Trevor, I think I'd be asking, what is the independent production sector in the UK doing about new talent and developing its existing talent?
That's a very good question. David Press.
Well, look, I think Trevor, the situation that we have at the moment is we have a very vibrant independent production sector, and this is close to what the television production sector was 20 years ago. We are now in that situation on the crest of breaking into quite considerable amounts of work and quite considerable amounts of potential for export, etc. And I think what we have as a sector is an issue about new talent coming in and being developed properly, and an issue about our existing talent being given professional development, ongoing professional development, which is what the buzzword everybody in skills talks about. And we haven't looked at that before. We're all small and medium-sized enterprises, largely. Some of us employing up to 40, 50 people, others employing maybe just one or two people. And we've all, as individuals, probably helped to nurture folk as they come in, as radio folk tend to do, but we haven't had any sort of structure on it or any sort of backup or any funding for doing that. And I think what we've managed to do through the Radio Independence Group and this organisation we set up, Rig Train, is to basically put some support in place for people who want to do that.
And you did a lot of the negotiation on behalf of Rig, and so you've got some funding from Skillset.
Yeah. Creative Skillset have been fantastic in coming in behind us and supporting it. What it effectively means is that we can roll out training programs run by individual companies. We can have regular masterclasses that we can get to a lot of people, a lot of learners on a regular basis. And then a very important part of it, which is the business leadership side of things, which we have, again, if you know, impress on you that we've got small and medium-sized enterprises. You know, we are not cash rich. A lot of us are supplying programs to organizations like the BBC where profit margins aren't huge, so we can't necessarily afford huge business leadership courses which are costing £4,000 or £5,000. So what we've got is a very well-supported leadership scheme which will allow 20 people from within our sector to have some really intensive work with them and with their companies and ongoing mentoring to hopefully grow the sector, their companies, and therefore the sector as a result.
So if I'm an ambitious young programme maker and I want to learn from, you know, the guy who does the reunion, that's you, the guy who does the feedback, that's you, is there going to be a course run by Whistledown or is it going to be run by Rig?
The courses are going to be run by individual companies themselves. So what we've got is that we're running one out of 20 courses, so don't get carried away with the fact that it's all coming from us. We've got science producers who are doing courses about how to convey science on the radio. We've got drama producers. We've got comedy writers. We've got production companies with expertise in specific areas like music production or sports broadcasting. This really is going to, if you like, the golden egg of knowledge and trying to kind of get something from them. Because what we've always had, I think, is that people who are trying to get into the sector or people who have got some experience in a certain area are trying to move into an area that they're interested in, it's all very much on a personal basis. If you email the right person at the right time, they may be interested in taking you on in a sort of some sort of role where they can train you up to be doing what you eventually want to do. There's nothing formal. There's nothing where you can say, oh, I've gone on a course which says that, you know, I've learnt the basics of comedy production or drama or studio producing for audiobooks. And that's what we're trying to do in a sense. And the bigger scheme is that we're hoping that it might even develop into something where we have a formal passport scheme, a little bit like what happens with the fashion industry, where people have certain skills that they can tick off in a passport and they can go from company to company and they say, look, I've got this level of expertise and experience and this company has signed me off and said, you know, yes, I have done this comedy production, etc., etc.
And what are these courses going to cost?
It'll be minimal, frankly. The courses are between £35 and £50 for a day course. The masterclasses are absolutely free. The leadership courses are priced less than £500. If you look at what's available at the moment, there is very little across the piece for people who are interested in finding out and learning a little bit, let's say, about comedy production. You can't any longer find a provider out there who will say, this is how you produce a panel show, or this is how you produce a comedy script. You can find a few sort of people on the fringes who are charging a large amount of money, and there was in the old days, you know, occasionally capacity on BBC courses. Again, that would cost quite a lot, £400-£500 for a day course. So what we're offering here is a very affordable way for people to gain that knowledge and gain that skill.
And where do people find out details?
Rigtrain.co.uk.
Rigtrain, all one word.
Yeah.
get on the love train.
Have a look at the, yeah, the website's been set up. It's rigtrain.co.uk. We're putting new courses up all the time, so you the best thing is to register on that so you get email alerts when new courses go up. At the moment, we have a mix of the masterclasses, which are coming up over the next 2 to 3 months, and some of the courses over the next 3 months. We're working about 3 months ahead of time, but as and when courses are designed and are planned and produced, as it were, by the companies, then they go up online and then they're available for booking.
Thanks very much, David. That was David Press from Whistledown. And if you didn't like that interview, then maybe you could write to feedback. How would that be, David?
Nothing to do with me.
Radio Moments. Radio Moments.
Given we're told Britain loves radio, it's hardly surprising that this Valentine's week in history has seen its fair share of station launches.
Kiss and Ibiza.
Kiss present the Prodigy. I'm a firestar. Friday, October the 4th.
Travel. Kiss 105. Music is life.
8 minutes after 6 o'clock and Valentine's Day, February the 14th. Jeff Roberts with you on the First Breakfast Live here on your new station for the county, BBC Hereford and Worcester. Hopefully the most informative breakfast show in the county to get you up and on the way every morning.
You're listening to Talk Radio UK, the nation's new station for talk entertainment on 1053 and 1089 medium wave.
Good morning, she is Samantha Meir.
And he's Sean Bolger.
And we're here every morning on Talk Radio UK.
The first moments in the life of Kiss Yorkshire on Valentine's Day 97, later Galaxy, now Capital, also of BBC Herefordshire and Worcestershire this week in 89, and of Talk Radio UK, the precursor of Talk Sport on Valentine's Day 95. Talk Radio was the last of the three national commercial stations to go on air, and it used the old Radio 1 medium wave frequency. Just one more loving launch to squeeze in, this featuring Laurence Olivier.
In the spring of 1774, we reached Brighthelmstone, a disagreeable place. There is scarce an object, either in it or near it, of nature or of art, that strikes the eye with any degree of beauty.
Hello, BBC Radio Brighton. Can I help you? Yes, Mrs. Holmwood, yes. For just one moment, and I'll take this down on the teleprinter.
Oh, we have a message here that's just come through to us. Telephone call, in fact, put through our teleprinter from Mrs. Holmwood of London Road, Brighton.
I think she sounds a little confused, doesn't she, about her teleprinters and her telephones. BBC Radio Brighton, launching on Valentine's Day 1970.
This is BBC Radio Brighton.
It was also on Valentine's Day 1970 that Ed Stewart began this show on Radio 2.
Hi, darling.
Thank you.
Sunday morning. Ed Stewart taking over Junior Choice from Leslie Crowther this week, 45 years ago. Junior Choice was the modern Radio 1 replacement for Children's Favourites, and Ed stayed on that show 12 years. This week in 1947, a national power crisis led to the BBC doing its bit. The Home Service and the Light Programme merged for 2 months, and the third programme was suspended altogether for 16 days. It wasn't until April that full broadcasting resumed. The record for the shortest ever tenure on Radio 1 Breakfast was 8 months. The arrival of that short-lived show was heralded this week, 18 years ago.
Hello? Hello? Yeah, hello, what? What, you want to talk to Mark Radcliffe? Somebody on the phone for you, kid.
Tell him I'm too busy, lad. Whoever it is, tell him I'm too busy.
Whoever you are, he's too busy.
Who is it?
Who is it? Oh, it's Roger Bannister.
Roger Bannister? What does he want? Tell him we're busy.
What do you want? We're busy. What?
What, what?
He wants us to do the breakfast show.
tell him there's no way we're getting up that early. Not no way.
Not no way, mate. We're not getting up that early, no.
No, what? And tell him, right, that it's a sellout anyway, and we're not going to compromise our principles,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a sellout, right? We're not going to compromise our principles, all right? Listen, no, mate, no. Not going up at that time. It's ridiculous. No chance, no, no, no. No, it's not about money. No. No, it is not about money. Do you not understand? How much?
Mark and Lard preparing for what turned out to be just 8 months on Radio 1 Breakfast this week in 97. 2MT was the first British station to make regular entertainment broadcasts. Transmissions began this week in 1922.
Well, I mean, how are you tonight? I'm afraid
little rather serious things have happened this evening. We did expect to get some rather famous singer, but, well, she failed. Singers fail, you know. They do. And we've got tonight a number of gramophone records, as usual.
2MT broadcasting from its old army hut next to the Marconi Lab at Rittle near Chelmsford. It broadcasts at 200 watts on a wavelength of 700 metres, 4 to 8 kilohertz from 8 o'clock until 8:30 on Tuesdays. 1974 now, and the launch of the first English commercial radio station outside London.
Good morning, my name's Kevin Morrison, and I'm pleased to be one of the first to welcome you to BRMB, the new independent radio station in Birmingham. Well, I'm going to be here every morning from now on, helping you to start your day the BRMB way.
I think that the success of the radio station and many of the other big commercial radio stations in Britain was because of the fact that they had rejected, the communities themselves had rejected the notion that everything had to come out of the capital city and had to have the name the BBC on it.
Programmer John Russell speaking of the early days of BRMB, this week 41 years ago. Bolton's Sarah Cox waved goodbye to Radio 1 this week last year after nearly 15 years.
Do you want to hear from your mum?
Oh, God. Jackie.
Shout out to Jackie.
Hi, sweetheart. It's your mum here.
I hope she sounds already like she's going to tell you off. Look. Now, where have you been?
I'm not having a go, but...
I hope you're enjoying every minute of your last day at Radio 1.
Oh.
Bet you're having a ball. Do you know what?
Oh.
I've been listening to you from day one.
Farewell, Sarah Cox, from Radio 1 this week in 2014. She was off to Radio 2. A final goodbye this week in 82 from one of radio's original commercial pioneers, Leonard Plug. Leonard was an entrepreneur, had a Tory politician, and whilst the BBC was ploughing on here in a BBC sort of way, Plug was starting stations overseas with powerful transmitters which could be heard here, and they were a bit more fun.
The success of these things was so fantastic. The south of England was our stamping ground. People would tune into Radio Normandy because that was when people used to, what they used to call, search the ether. This was twiddly old knobs of their set and pick up stations from all over the continent. And the better the set, the further they could range. So that when they heard these English programs, particularly as the BBC was not on the air, they would tune into these things like crazy because we put out the kind of things that Radio 1 now and local commercial radio puts out ad nauseum, all the pop music.
Bob Danvers Walker reflecting on Radio Normandy, one of the ventures set up by Leonard Plug, who died this week 33 years ago.
This is Radio Normandy broadcasting on its new wavelength of 274 metres.
So, with the last Letter from America with Alastair Cook 11 years ago.
And hope for a perfect lullaby before drifting into sleep.
Big Ben going into daily use 91 years ago. A fader left open at Jazz FM 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And Wogan returning to Weekend Radio 2 5 years ago.
God, it's been hell without you.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments.
Thank you, David Lloyd, David Prest, Paul Eaton, and of course you for listening. This has been a TDC production, and we'll be back next week with a report from the Radio Academy's Make or Break EGM. Ooh. See you then.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.